Hi, I'm Jeff Davis. In this episode of On the Wine Road, I'm heading over to St. Helena in Napa Valley. I'm glad you could come along. You know, Wine and Spirits magazine's top 100 issue is a rich resource, one I've gone to in the past and will again in the future. Chorus and Winery was another from this year's list that I featured on my radio show. And I'm guessing the reason Kathy Corison's bottle of 2013 Kronos Vineyard Cabernet Sauvignon was the only wine from the U.S. on the cover, along with four international wines, is because she's highly respected at the magazine. I couldn't pass up the opportunity to meet up with her and share her story. Let's get right to it.
On your website, I found quite a statement that your career began on a whim by taking a wine appreciation course at Pomona College. And can you believe that whim led to winemaking positions at several respected wineries? And according to Wine and Spirits magazine, you now own one of the top 100 wineries in the world. That was quite a whim.
Yeah, I would say a whim, but it's also serendipity. I think I've learned to wait for it. And I'm just a very lucky duck. I was 19 years old. Who knew? 2 years later, I graduated from college. 2 days later, I was here in Napa with this vague notion that I wanted to make world-class wine. I don't think I even fully knew what that was, you know. So yeah, it's a bit of a miracle.
Well, and to your credit and serendipitous situation, you were pursuing biology, and that's a good education to have for winemaking. It works well for a lot of winemakers having that knowledge. And then you did end up going to UC Davis as well, right?
Right. Well, wine is alive. It's the collaboration of a whole series of living systems. And they collaborate, and the result is the alchemy in our glass. We frankly don't understand it that well, but it's Mother Nature makes the wine. We don't. Yeah. So the other question, back in the day, that was almost 45 years ago, I went to Davis, one, because I think a good winemaker needs to have a good technical foundation, no matter what. But I also knew, as a woman in this industry, I needed that piece of paper just for legitimacy.
Good idea. Tell me about the wineries you worked for previously. Some are well-known, and a couple others are not so much.
Well, my first commercial vintage was as an intern at Fremark Abbey Winery. And in those days, it was very famous for its Chardonnays. And they hired an intern, a student from Davis, as an intern every year. So it was just a wonderful opportunity for me to do the second half of my education. There was the technical foundation, but then there was another whole education. The nuts and bolts of running a cellar were key if I wanted to make wine on a small scale, and I already knew I did. So Fremark Abbey, 1978, I was a cellar intern. I was the bottom of the totem pole. I cleaned the press every night in the middle of the night, and I sanitized all the tanks and shoveled out the pumice, and it was a great education. From there, in those days, I was very, very lucky. All of us that got out of school in those days were very lucky. The industry was exploding. It had been really shut down at Prohibition, and that had ended in 1933, but the industry was such a shambles that it took until into the 60s and into the early 70s for it to really start to bloom again here in Napa. And by the time I got here, it was just exploding. So there were a lot of opportunities for all of us coming out of school. We were all running wineries way before we should have been. But it was extremely lucky. Again, serendipitous, great timing. And so from Fremark Abbey, I literally worked there for 8 months because I had finished my degree at Davis. And so I had the luxury of staying there for 8 months. And then from there, I went to a full control winemaking position up on Spring Mountain, and that was Everdon, and that's a winery that's long defunct. The building's still there, and it's had various other wineries in it, but I believe they stopped making wine when I left there in 1979, I think.
Because they knew they could never match the quality that you put into it?
No, no, no. It folded around me, actually. He was an older gentleman and just decided to do something else. And then from there, I went to Chapelet, which was already very well known for its Cabernets up on Pritchard Hill. And I did all the 1980s there, all 10 vintages up there. So a very, very lucky duck.
Quite a jump to go from Fremark Abbey in the cellar to being a winemaker in your next position.
It was crazy, but there weren't enough little old white guys around. Yeah, so there were opportunities for a lot of us in those days.
That was, of course, partially due to the post-Paris tasting of 76. I imagine things just went really nuts after that.
I'd say it was largely due to that. Yeah, it was explosive.
I imagine as you were gaining your knowledge and expertise in the 70s and 80s, wines, particularly Cabernet Sauvignons, may have been more like what you're making now, not the bigger, fruitier, more alcoholic wines that became the trend in the 90s and 2000s.
Yes, I think fashion in wines comes and goes. So that's layered in on top of the fact that when I first got here, we were just learning worldwide, just learning about canopy management and learning how to grow better grapes. When I first got to the Napa Valley in the mid-70s, grape growing consisted of pruning and picking. So crops were much bigger in those days, and there was much less manipulation of the canopy. And so they did pick at lower sugars than many do today, but it's not the same as when I pick at lower sugars now. I'm picking fully ripe grapes with very moderate crop loads packed with flavor and complexity. I think there was more vintage variation in those days. You could have a great vintage like 1970, where no matter what you did, it was truly a great vintage. But I think now we've leveled it out. I think we can make better wines year in and year out because of everything we've learned about growing grapes.
2011 is a fine example of that.
Perfect example. I pick early on early sites. Basically, these are gravel pits, these vineyards here on the benchland. So I was very lucky in 2011 that I could get Cabernet ripe. And I love my 11s. They were ripe at lower sugars, but they're beautiful wines. There were other places, through nobody's fault, that couldn't get Cabernet ripe. But here on the bench, yeah. Yeah, and if we hadn't, I think 20 years before, we wouldn't have made as good wines in 11. We didn't know as much.
Right. When you were nearing your tenure at Chapelet, did you already have in mind what you wanted to do, and you kind of saw, I'm going to do things a little differently, and I have this in mind, and so you were ready to move on?
It's not so much about doing things differently. I had a different, stylistically, I had a different notion. There was this wine inside of me that needed to get out, and it was not a mountain wine. And in fact, I made wine for 3 vintages for myself while I was still up there. It's crazy.
Well, a lot of winemakers do that. You have the opportunity to use their services, their crush pads, and their equipment. It's an easier way to start your own business.
Well, and Don Chapelet was wonderful to work for. I was always grateful that he encouraged me to do that.
Well, you certainly have a favorite variety and place, Cabernet Sauvignon and the Benchlands. And it is interesting, we were talking about this a little earlier, the difference between the grapes grown in the valley floor and the Benchlands and the mountainside. And you certainly have a strong appreciation for the Benchlands.
Well, I just love wine. But this wine that was fully formed in my head before I started making it was a Benchland wine. I was looking to make Cabernet that was both powerful and elegant. Cabernet is going to be powerful. It doesn't matter how you grow it, how you pick it, what you do, it's going to be powerful. But for me, it's much more interesting at the intersection of elegance, and they almost sound like opposites, but they can be in the same glass at the same time. And that's what I've been chasing all my adult life.
And that's a perfect descriptor of how her wines are, powerful and elegant. They age very well, too. There's a great article on that topic from Eric Asimov. If you Google Eric Asimov and Corison, Corison, you'll find a New York Times article from 2015. Let me warn you, after reading it, you'll want to rush right over to Napa Valley and try her Cabernet and other wines. A moment ago, Kathy mentioned she likes to make wine at the point where power and elegance intersect. I mentioned to her that some winemakers like to continue past that intersection in one way or the other, passing by that balance of power and elegance.
Yeah, that's, you know, at some point, winemaking becomes art, and we all are expressing a different thing. To some extent, when wine is made by one person, it reflects the hand that made it.
And your wines are certainly artful. Yeah, they're quite appealing and to the palate, like art is to the eye. And surprisingly, you've never reached over 14% in alcohol, huh?
Nope. Any wine I've ever made has been under 14%, and I've never de-alcoholized a wine. So, great grapes make great wine, and I can't make the wines any better than the grapes that come in the door. So I spend most of my time out there, and the most important decision I make all year is when to pick those grapes, because we don't make the wine. Mother Nature makes the wine. They're living and breathing. They come into the winery, and a living, breathing organism converts them to wine, the yeast. So I just stay out of the way.
And you're fortunate enough to have at least a couple of the vineyards right here on your estate and next to your estate. Tell me about your vineyards that you source from.
Well, way back 31 years ago, when I started in 1987, I came to the benchland because of the way, and benchland is just the alluvial fans coming out of the hills. So they tend to be loamy soils. They have good water holding capacity, so the vines have the water they need to grow in the spring and into the early summer. But because we have completely rainless summers, it's like turning off the faucet. Basically, I came to this little corner of the world because I knew it would make aromatic wines with velvety tannins and good natural acidity and lots of complexity, and that's the wine that was in my head. So that's why my vineyards are here. And I made wines from the benchland for a very long time before I owned any benchland vineyards. We didn't purchase Kronos Vineyard until 1995. And then we purchased Sunbasket less than 3 years ago, though I had sourced it for almost 30 years through several owners.
And how fortunate for you to be able to purchase this vineyard, the Kronos Vineyard, and have a place to build your winery. And you refurbished the house that was on the property, and here you are. So that worked out very nicely.
Yet another series of miracles. Yeah, a very lucky duck.
And your husband was played a major role in that, didn't he?
Absolutely. I know how to make wine, but I never could have done all this without him. He found the Kronos Vineyard. He arranged to buy Sunbasket Vineyard. He designed the winery and made it happen. He refurbished the house. He's the IT department. He does all the books and accounting. He's the best forklift driver I've ever met. He grew up on a lumber yard, and he's the forklift driver, and he keeps the machines running. And so it's truly Ma and Pa here.
And his name's William, right?
It is William.
At least put his name out there.
William Martin, specifically.
And you really seem to have an appreciation for the past. You honor the long history of winemaking, the winemaking process, with the images on your labels.
Yeah, humans started to ferment things as soon as they settled down at all, and probably before they settled down. But the images on my label come from what we call the Fertile Crescent. It's where humans first, it's in the Middle East today, and it's where humans first settled down and started to grow grapes and make wine, and they made beer as well. And the blue symbol on my label is based on rain from a civilization 7,000 years ago. And the archaeologists know that they made wine because they find tartrates in their pots. And the European wine grape variety is unique in having a lot of tartaric acid. Most other fruits have other major acids, but it's almost a marker of Vitis vinifera to have so much tartaric acid. So they know that back in those days, those cultures were making wine.
Well, I like it. I love that reaching back so far into history.
And then the other major symbol on my label is it's a sprouting seed. It looks very Celtic, but it's another life symbol based on a sprouting seed. And the sprouting seed is actually on the Corus and Cabernet capsule on top.
And you do have the other labels, the Corazon label, and you have a rosé of Cabernet Sauvignon.
So we also bottled the rosé under the Corazon label. I reserve the Corazon label for Cabernet Sauvignon. We make a little bit of Cabernet Franc. We are very proud of it. Now we own that vineyard at Sunbasket, Cabernet Franc, and we vineyard designate it. But we still put it under the Helios label because it's not Cabernet Sauvignon. And William designed that label as well. And yeah.
Does the sun label, the image of the sun on that label, relate to the sun basket?
Absolutely. Yeah. And he grew up in upstate New York where the sun didn't shine very much. So I think he values the sun more than native Californians might.
And then you go way out into left field and have a Gewürztraminer.
Well, that wine is inspired by the wines of Alsace, and I've always loved the wines of Alsace. They make wines from Germanic aromatic whites, but with French sensibilities, and they're fascinating wines, and they're wonderful with food. So, yeah, I just couldn't bring myself to make another Chardonnay. It's wonderful to have a white wine for a reception, like when you walked in the door, and I do a few winemaker dinners throughout the year, and all it gives me a white wine for a first course. So,
and yeah, it was full of flavor. It was, as we were walking around, I was getting different flavors on my palate, and it's really nice.
Well, it's totally dry, and they're terrific with food. Good, snappy, natural acidity. The grapes do not come from the Napa Valley. It's far too warm here for a great Gewürztraminer. They're from up in Anderson Valley, a couple hours drive north, where it's much cooler. Yeah. And it's an old vineyard. It's a very old vineyard. And so, it is very complex.
It certainly was a nice wine to start off the day at 11 o'clock.
Breakfast of champions.
So is this the course you're on? You're just going to stay the course? Or do you have anything new in the works that you're thinking about?
I'm probably asked that once a week. And my answer is always that I want to make wine better, not I don't want to make more wine. I make the wine, and always have, and I raised two daughters all the while, and for a long, long time sold it all, and wear a lot of hats. Grow the grapes, make the wine, run the winery, sell the wine. I have a lot more help than I used to, but I never could have wrapped myself around anything bigger than this. And now, I want to be making wine when I'm 99, but my peers are thinking about retiring, and so I like the idea of making just a little bit of wine.
But continuing to do so.
Till I'm 99, unless I live longer.
Winemakers so rarely retire before their time is through. The calm and determined Kathy Corison. It was a true pleasure to sit with her for a while, enjoy a palate-pleasing tasting of her wine, and spend some time in her vineyards. Her website is easy to remember, Corison.com, Corison.com. If you're listening to this on iTunes or another podcast provider, you can learn more about my show at OnTheWineRoad.com and on Facebook as well. If you'd like to join my wine community and ensure these podcasts will continue to come your way, find me on Patreon at patreon.com/onthewineroad, patreon.com. I'm Jeff Davis. Thank you so much for joining me on The Wine Road.